and send him the ship's manifest you obtained in the previous step. Praji will then do the comparison and notice the missing escape pod.
But then he's going to ask me why I didn't shoot the pod when it jettisoned, which puts me back exactly where I started.
We're not done yet, I said. The trick with data work is layering and complementing.
Sounds like you're talking about fashion, he muttered. I let it slide.
Your goal is building an unassailable structure for diverting responsibility elsewhere. A kind of escape pod for yourself, if you will. So far, I've taught you how to get Hija out of the way and how to lead Praji to discover the missing escape pod. And the only remaining piece is to erase any hint that you could be responsible.
How?
He spat. I could tell he was about ready to grab my lapels and shake me. I deliberately slowed down. You're going to file a maintenance request NIW-59-SUD with a Schedule P. He groaned pitifully. He was like a drowning man ready to give up on the straw he was clutching.
What is that going to do?
Time to explain the coup de grace. This is the form you use to report visibility-impaired viewports and view screens and request a cleaning.
A cleaning?
That's right. Specifically, a washing of the viewports and view screens near your workstation. He just looked at me.
A viewport washing? What? How? Why?
Once you put the request in, maintenance will dispatch multiple droids to the station you designate. I suggest where you and Hija were standing and cover every viewport and view screen with a thick white foam. The droids will even do it from the outside of the viewports. It's the latest cleaning and polishing agent from the Imperial Labs, specifically designed to remove laser scarring and scorching from battles. I watched his face go through the stages of terror, confusion, anger, disbelief, astonishment, epiphany, rapture.
Cover all the viewports?
He stuttered. That's right. All of them.
With a thick foam?
Very thick. Can't see a thing through them. Can't see the stars, or the Tantivy IV, or even Tattoo...
Or any escape pods. Oh, Arvira, this is brilliant.
This will explain why you couldn't see any escape pods from where you were. Praji will just assume that the escape pod was jettisoned without anyone detecting it.
And he will have to then bring the bad news to Lord Vader and face the consequences.
That smile on his face was truly delightful to see. I loved helping people. Exactly. Now, go and get all the data work done ASAP. You've still got time. He got up, tablet in hand, and ran for the door. But before exiting, he turned around.
What can I do to make this up to you? A game of cards tomorrow night?
Uh-huh. So maybe he didn't know much about data work, but he did know how to pay for a favor without being too obvious. Maybe. But you know, I've always wanted to know what it's like to fire the guns on this thing. Even data work wizards like, pew, 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 you know? He grinned.
I'm sure I can work out a target practice session sometime.
I waved for him to go and returned to my endless data work, glad to have laid down another strand in my invisible web of influence.
Stories in the Sand by Griffin McElroy. If one were to try to find the perfect summation of what life on Tatooine is really like, the sparseness, the intolerable dryness of it all, one would not need to look further than the sand crawlers that checker the planet's surface with fleeting tread marks each day. Every centimeter of a sandcrawler is prudently designed to fit the ship's grueling function. And sandcrawlers have a lot of centimeters. Each ship is an identical monument to practicality and performs each day's work with exacting precision. They do so indomitably, overcoming Tatooine's considerable environmental hazards with ease. On the uppermost deck of a sand crawler stationed in the western dune sea, a sloped bulk belt carried scrap hoisted from the sands below to a salvage bay seated at the vessel's peak. Underneath that belt was a small hidden gap, measuring 1 meter long and at the incline's tallest point, half a meter high, with a width most non-Jawas would find oppressive. It was an unintended compartment in a vehicle shrewdly designed for maximized efficiency of space. In this wedge-shaped gap, a Jawa named Jot dreamed of starships. Jot had discovered the compartment by accident while working an intake shift, sorting the unceasing flow of metallic debris that the sandcrawler sucked up into its powerful magnetic maw. A particularly lustrous thermal dissipator had caught his eye as he pushed ancient alloys into piles according to their worth or usefulness to the crew. But as he reached to pocket the dissipator, Jot watched it slip sideways between the bulk belt and the ship's hull, tumbling downward and out of sight. Jot searched for the missing dissipator during his limited break time over the next 9 days, hoping not to attract the attention of his peers during his tireless hunt. By pressing a slight frame behind the maglift's pneumatic servos, he could edge his way prone, then pry a flimsy rectangular aluminum panel from the bulk belt's housing, giving him an entryway he could just scrape through, so long as his slightly round belly never ever got any rounder. It was a clumsy act of contortion, but luckily for Jot, he was likely the only Jawa aboard the sandcrawler who could pull it off. This was because Jot was very small, even by Jawa standards. When Jawas first learn to walk, they're given the insulated, moisture-regulating robes that will sustain them their whole lives. As infants, their robes are hemmed nearly to the armpit, the fabric doubled and folded within. As Jawas mature, the hem is lowered to better cover their newfound height. Most Jawas measure themselves by the number of hems they've had put in. The average Jawa has 5 or 6 by the time they reach adulthood, leaving telltale striations in the thick brown canvas of their life-giving garment. Jot's robe had been hemmed twice. After several months of practice, Jot could slip in and out of his space in seconds. It was vital he keep the maneuver fast and surreptitious. He couldn't let anyone know about his gap. To say the compartment wasn't especially comfortable would be a disservice to the very idea of discomfort. It was, as the previously mentioned dimensions suggest, cramped, especially when filled with the various baubles Jot had tucked away while on salvage duty. During his shifts, he could simply push items that caught his eye off the side of the belt and directly into his collection. Due to the relative ease of this process, his already sizable hoard had grown exponentially. That one benefit nearly outweighed the gap's drawbacks, of which there were many. The rolling belt that served as the gap's ceiling occasionally sagged under the weight of particularly heavy pieces of salvage, flirting with but never quite buckling. The starboard wall of the gap was actually the sandcrawler's outer hull, which grew unbearably hot to the touch 14 hours of the day. There was enough room in the gap for Jot to sit without leaning against the starboard wall, so its searing heat wasn't an issue, so long as he didn't absent-mindedly try to stretch out and get comfortable while admiring his hoard. Unfortunately for Jot, losing his concentration was one of his most honored pastimes. It was not uncommon for passers-by to hear a muffled yelp coming from the gully works of the lift's machinery, followed by the uniquely unpleasant smell of singed Jawa fur wafting down the sandcrawler's corridors. Those faults didn't hamper Jot's contentment with his secret dwelling. Silence, privacy, and solitude weren't just in short supply on the sandcrawler. The ship was overstaffed and bloated with cargo, both of which created an environment where the concept of personal space was foreign. Jot never knew how much he needed that space until he had it. Now the idea of living without it was unthinkable. He did not dislike his life on the Sandcrawler. It was certainly preferable to the monotony of fortress living, but his hours spent working salvage seemed longer, emptier since finding the gap. Every minute he spent sorting sandblasted metal was a minute he spent away from himself, away from his home, away from Storyteller. The dunes of Tatooine look barren to most off-worlders who, for some typically illicit reason or another, find themselves visiting. That appraisal isn't completely unfair. Life on Tatooine is as difficult as you'd expect from a planet where moisture is scarce to the point of deserving its own economy. But every Jawa, especially those who ship out on a crawler, knows the truth. The surface of the dunes is lifeless, yes, but the sand stretches downward forever. Entombed in the endless gritty expanse were more downed ships than there were ships in the sky. More droids than any 10 factories could produce in a century. More wealth, more resources, more history than could ever be excavated or recorded. There was not a Jawa on Tatooine who did not believe wholeheartedly that there was more sand below them than there was sky above. The sand, Jawas knew, was more fertile than any off-worlder could ever guess, and the wind was its constant farmer. Most Jawas could tell you tales of unimaginable relics exhumed by a sharp breeze, assuming you spoke fluent trade, or even Jawaese, which you almost certainly don't. Strange meteors buried in their own glass-crusted craters. Ancient cruisers the size of small cities. For that matter, actual small cities. Entire civilizations that had long since dried up and died of thirst, lost to time. Jot had told the story of his discovery more times than he could count. Every moment of it remained crystal clear in his mind. The small protrusion of bone poking out of the ground several meters from his family's cramped clay dwelling. The shock of pain that shot up his arm as he cut his hand on something under the dirt. How the wind that night, matching the frenzy of his curiosity, revealed Jot's discovery in full the next morning. A crate dragon. A big one. The biggest Jot had ever seen, he would interject forcefully with each telling. Immediately below the home in which Jot was born, and thousands of years before that, a crate dragon had died and been pristinely preserved by Jot's front yard. There were very few Jawas who had ever met Jot who hadn't heard that story. Most on the Sandcrawler had heard it more than once, and very few had the patience for further retellings. As important as it once had been to him, Jot was also growing tired of the tale. The scenes he once recounted with exuberance seemed less remarkable with each performance. He had leaned too hard on his story, and he knew he was robbing it of its luster. Several weeks after Jot discovered the gap below the bulk belt, the wind blew fiercely over the dunes near his sandcrawler, pulling a new story up from the depths. The sandcrawler's crew was asleep, enjoying a rare off-duty night while the ship rode out a massive windstorm that threatened to flood their engines with grit. The next morning, a long-dormant freighter had been uncovered so completely on a nearby dune that the first Jawas to see it would have sworn it had crash-landed while the ship's crew ate breakfast. It was the biggest score the Sandcrawler had found in months, and every Jawa on board delighted in ransacking it. Within the hour, the freighter had been thoroughly shucked. Small hands ripped and sawed and pried at every panel, every cable, every millimeter of circuitry within. The species of the ship's long-dead pilot was unidentifiable, but their profession was evinced by the cockpit's less savory salvage. A modified blaster rifle, thermal detonators, ancient Mandalorian armor and a still-functioning data pad that held several hundred expired warrants for criminals throughout the galaxy. This pilot was a bounty hunter, and based on the quality of their gear, an awfully successful one. Jot was bullied into scouting the dig site's perimeter while the rest of the crew picked the ship clean for valuables, most of which would end up squirreled away in the spacious pockets of their robes. It wasn't the first time Jot had been buffaloed into an unwanted task by his clan. He was of a size that was terribly convenient for bullies. During his half-hearted reconnaissance, Jot noticed a figure partially buried on the opposite side of the dune from where his team found the crashed freighter. Embedded up to its midsection was an astromech droid, an outdated, bulky black bucket that had not been nearly as well preserved as the bounty hunter's other belongings. A large, rusted hole in its central hull showcased telltale signs of fusion cell corrosion, which inevitably meant every component of its core chassis was well beyond repair. The droid's dome, however, was intriguing. Jot had seen several astromech droids tumble down the salvage line to be repaired, cleaned, and sold. This unit was clearly a custom job. Its holo projector was installed into a secondary processing unit, complete with its own discrete data drive and internal power source. All this custom hardware was housed in a single detachable fixture, which, as near as Jot could tell, also made this processor completely redundant. For some reason, that long-dead bounty hunter had given his droid a second brain. Working carefully, Jot ran his driver across the shallow seam under the droid's domed head, granting access to this peculiar construction, which, to Jot's delight, could be easily slid out of its socket. Jot tucked the whole hollow projector unit into the folds of his robe. It was only fair that he took home a prize, too, he figured. Jot raced back to the sandcrawler, back to the privacy of his wedge-shaped compartment, grateful that his shipmates were too occupied with the freighter to notice his clumsy attempt at smuggling. He cleared a place for the device in the center of the compartment, giving it more space among the scrap than he gave himself. Jawas are not known for their sense of aesthetics, and Jot was no exception. But he appreciated the fit of the holo projector unit in his tiny space. He had thought of this room as his own, and had been fiercely secretive about it since he first discovered it. Now the gap belonged to the projector. They felt intended for each other, pieces that interlocked by design. After several minutes of meticulously sorting his collection into neat piles, Jot dug up a memory core that he had found in the gap during his very first visit. He lifted the core to his mouth and pressed his tongue gently against its metal contacts and felt a harsh, sour jolt course through him. Good. The core's internal battery was still functioning, meaning the data inside was probably still intact. He nervously inserted the memory core into the holo projector unit's drive, and the device immediately whirred to life. Beneath the device's visible interface, not that Jot would have been able to decipher the process, even if he could see it, complex subroutines simultaneously examined, counter-programmed, and decrypted the memory core's contents, displaying them seconds later through the holoprojector's lens. Jot wasn't aware of this, but this description software was as sophisticated as it was illegal. Exceptionally, preposterously illegal. For a moment, the gap was flooded with formless gray light. It caught Jot by surprise, momentarily blinding him, sending him reeling, panicked, into the compartment's blistering hot starboard wall. Within seconds, the light retreated to a few centimeters in front of the projector, taking shape with remarkable clarity. Jot's vision cleared. He saw stars, not the remnants of the flash. Stars. He saw the soft curvature of Tatooine near the bottom of the projection, its surface lined with bloated stripes of muted orange, amber, and tan, punctuated with an enormous red crater. He saw the bow of a starship peeking up into the projection, the back of the pilot's head barely visible in the bridge. The ship was rolling slowly counterclockwise, but the pilot jerked it back into alignment. Then another roll, then a correction, and so on. The ship was crashing, but it had not crashed, which meant, for the next few minutes at least, Jot could continue to witness its descent. This custom droid component had given Jot a first-hand account of a ship's final doomed flight through the stars. When Storyteller first flashed this image into existence, Jot's eyes flooded with stinging tears. Seeing this story, seeing stars and flight, and the only planet he'd ever lived on from kilometers above, his eyes would not dry for some time. Jot couldn't recall when his desire to leave Tatooine first surfaced. As a child, he loved to tinker with whatever busted gadgets the sands of Tatooine proffered. Hollow chessboards, land speeder engines, droid servo motors, and the like. He was encouraged to pursue his experimentation. But it wasn't nearly enough to satisfy his curiosity. He hungered for the opportunity to bury himself in the guts of a Corellian corvette, to optimize the thrusters of a starfighter, to repair the hyperdrive motivator of a galactic cruiser carrier. Jot, of course, did not have the first clue how to do any of those things. But that wasn't really a concern. Starships, like everything else, were just parts. They might interlock in inscrutable ways, but by Jot's calculation, when broken down the requisite number of levels, everything in the universe was made of connected parts. Sandcrawlers comprised specialized systems that let them operate in Tatooine's harsh environment. Those systems were made of complex and simple machines, all of which were made from interlocking parts. The bright white bones of Jot's Cray Dragon were just parts of a skeleton, engineered over countless generations by unforgiving biological imperatives. The stars, too, were parts of a sort. Jot knew as much about astronomy as he did about galactic carrier cruiser hyperdrive motivators, but he knew the stars moved through the sky in a set, immutable order. If it had parts, it could be understood. Jot knew that, given enough time inside a starship, he could learn its parts, learn how to make them behave. And if he could learn how to make them behave, Jot could earn his place in the sky. Jot was insatiable now. With Storyteller and a private place in which to enjoy its tales, Jot's lack of enthusiasm for his work on the Sandcrawler had become problematic. A few days after discovering Storyteller, Jot had missed an entire shift pouring through his salvaged memory core. He had looped through its contents countless times, watching archived business transactions, slideshows of exotic vacations, and messages exchanged with loved ones. He couldn't understand a word of those messages, but their sender, a bald, cheerful older man, was almost always belting out a warm, deep laugh that brought a smile to Jot's face. And then he would watch the core's final recording, breathless and sick as this cheerful man's ship careened downward to its final resting place deep within the dunes. Jot treasured the stories on this memory core, but he knew that stories, when told exhaustively, lose their magic. He refused to ruin these recordings with overexertion. Storyteller needed new stories to tell. Jot requested a transfer off the salvage line, which his supervisor, frustrated with Jot's recently spotty attendance, was more than happy to grant. Jot was placed on the final prep team, operating out of the ship's loading bay. It was a few decks away from his gap, making it difficult for Jot to take Storyteller breaks during his shift. But the position offered a benefit that made up for that inconvenience. The job Jot carved out for himself was in firmware repair, a role he performed by optimizing the loading speed of memory cores within droids that were ready to sell. Most Jawas aren't exemplary computer scientists, but reformatting a memory core to clear its cache, was an extremely straightforward operation. This kind of reformatting was standard practice on salvage ships like this one. Customers wanted to believe their products to be as new as possible, despite purchasing them from an enormous mobile dumpster. After 2 days of on-the-job training, Jot excelled at increasing performance for the ship's outgoing product. His new supervisor was delighted with his efficacy, but was confused by Jot's refusal to do his work in the loading bay alongside the rest of the prep team. Had she really stopped to think about it, Jot's supervisor would realize she didn't quite know where Jot was doing his work. Jot's days in his new position were filled with uninterrupted delight. He was able to spend a majority of his time in the gap, where he'd spirit away with a new memory core for Storyteller to decrypt and explore. He watched the new stories with rapt attention, trying to memorize each and every detail, making silent promises to remember them to the best of his ability. He had to remember, because after viewing each memory core, Jot gently removed its casing and carefully detached its internal battery, instantly erasing its contents in the pursuit of optimization. Jot deplored doing it, but if his work performance suffered, he would be cut off from this infinite supply of stories. He could view the projections only once. Then he destroyed them forever, spending the following hours reintegrating the memory unit back into the droid that had housed it. The heartbreak Jot felt with each erasure was worth it, given the wonder of the preceding hours. Jot's second-hand memories took him to the far reaches of the galaxy, to places few Tatooinean eyes had ever witnessed. A forest of towering pointy trees that blanketed an entire planet in lush greens and crimsons. The pristine bridge of an imperial freighter, bathed in even lines of white neon. A city of glowing lights hidden under the waters of a perfectly still sea. And into the stars. Astromech droids' memory cores were filled with the most spectacular logs of their owners' flights. In those stories, Jot would push back the hood of his robe and lift his face into the hologram, surrounding himself with the illusion of passing stars. He would close his eyes as he approached the image, then open them, and for a moment, his mind could trick itself into thinking this was his flight, his ship, his sky. Those moments of delusion were the happiest of Jot's planet-bound life. It was Jot's preference for astromech droid memories that led him to stake out a peculiar R2 unit acquired by snatchers in the canyons outside of Mos Eisley. It had caught nearly everyone's eye on the prep team, mostly because of how little prep it actually needed. Most droids that came down the line needed exhaustive scouring to give their rusted chassis some semblance of presentability to the customer. This R2 unit looked like it hadn't spent a minute in the dunes. Its components weren't flooded with sand. Its treads looked like they had been replaced yesterday. Its blue and white chassis still had paint, which the desert winds wouldn't have permitted for very long. A few burn marks tarnished its otherwise pristine exterior. Not ion burns from a trigger-happy snatcher, but actual blaster scoring. This R2 unit was a mystery to everyone on board. Jot knew exactly how to solve it. With even more reverence than he usually exerted, Jot removed the R2 unit's memory core from its nearly flawless housing and stole away to the cap. He pressed its contacts to his tongue and reflexively yelped as it gave him a potent retaliatory shock. He clasped a hand over his mouth and hoped nobody had heard him, waiting silently to ensure he hadn't betrayed the secrecy of his compartment. After several tense, quiet minutes, he proceeded. He loaded the memory core into Storyteller, and for the first time, Jot's extraordinary felonious droid had some difficulty decrypting its contents. Storyteller whirred worryingly, dedicating more power to the task than Jot thought its small frame was capable of producing. But Storyteller completed its assault with a satisfied chime, laying the R2 unit story out to bear. Jot's chest sank inside his robe, his mind racing to memorize the odyssey he was witnessing. He watched the R2 unit perform a daring repair on the wing of a sleek silver starship, flak bursting all around its station, missing by centimeters. He watched the R2 unit race through an enormous droid factory, a cavernous building, all metal and molten lava, a monolith that put his sandcrawler to shame. He watched the R2 unit bear witness to some sort of ceremony. A man in black, a woman in a lovely veil, a solemn kiss exchanged over a lake at sunset. He saw armies of droids as far as the eye could see. He saw swords made of fire. He saw robed people who could actually use magic. The magic people were fighting each other using the fire swords. A pair of them laid low an entire platoon of droids using their magic. Jot was mystified, enraptured. He leaned against the scalding hull 1, 2, 3, 4 seconds before even realizing it. The picture flickered, and Storyteller projected another memory. Jot saw a woman wearing a long white robe. Her hair was swirled into tight wheels around her ears. She spoke to an unseen audience for less than a minute, then crouched, her calm demeanor shifting to worry for the first time, her arm extending, readying a blaster. Jot could not understand her. He could not understand the languages spoken in any of his stories. But even without hearing her message, Jot could read the concern on her face as plain as day. This was a warning. And the R2 unit's final story showed Jot exactly what her warning was about. A starship, the size of a planet. A round, beautiful, hateful vessel with a scale beyond comprehension. Of all the impossible images Jot had seen in this R2's memories, this was the most outlandish, and for reasons he didn't understand, the most terrifying. A cold, bubbling fear climbed his throat as he studied the diagram. The warm security of his secret compartment drained away, and for the first time since discovering the gap, he felt completely exposed. He felt watched. Moments before the image blinked off, Jot noticed a string of numbers in the corner. A date and time. This story had been backed up off an external media source within the past 2 days. This wasn't like the other stories Jot had borrowed from the desert-weary droids he serviced. This wasn't an ancient flight log of a long-crashed freighter, or the final moments in the life of a wandering abandoned droid. This story, with the magic and the fire swords and the crouching woman and the planet-sized ship, it was happening right now! The gravity of this realization descended on Jot suddenly. His face went numb. His entire life, Jot had happily served as spectator to the stories that constantly unfolded around him. Even in the tale of his great dragon, he wasn't the star. His brothers were the first to find the skeleton that morning. His father finished excavating it. His mother adorned the skull with a crown of desert sage and funnel flowers. Jot was just there. But being there wasn't good enough now. The next part of this droid story, if not a chapter, just a line, was Jot's responsibility to author. Like the glistening bones of his dragon, like the stars in the sky, like every panel and fiber and joiner in the machines he had worked with every day of his life, Jot was now a part of something too. For the first time, he felt like he wasn't just a passive observer of the story of his life. He was a participant. It was an enlightenment, the likes of which few are lucky enough to experience during the span of their lives. Jot just happened to find it in a furnace-hot, coffin-sized design flaw in the side of a rolling junkyard. Storyteller ejected the R2 droid's memory core, its chronicles expended. Chot stowed it in the folds of his twice-hemmed robe, its data still intact. The thought of carrying out the data wipe didn't even cross his mind. Chot didn't believe himself worthy to participate in this droid story. He certainly did not deserve to bring it to an unceremonious end. Chot wriggled his way out of the compartment, unconcerned about being spotted as he squeezed through its secret entrance and back into plain sight. He ran, stumbling, down the sandcrawler's decks and gasped with relief upon seeing the still deactivated R2 droid in the loading dock. He loaded its memory core back into its housing, hands trembling with excitement. Chot knew his dereliction of duty would eventually be discovered by some hapless customer after the R2 unit was reactivated and brought out to market. He didn't care. His departure from the sandcrawler was imminent and long overdue. Tomorrow, he would leave the salvage team. He would find a ship in Mos Eisley or Anchorhead that would have him no matter what. He would see the stars and write stories about each and every one of them. He would become an irreplaceable part of more and more designs until at long last, he could see fully the shape of the machine that was made for him.
Ryron by Saba Tahir. The boy talked too much. If Ryron ever yapped with such disrespect at her elders, she'd be nursing a bruised bottom and milking banthas until her fingers turned blue for good. Though the old man wasn't much better, hemming and hawing over the droids like a Nymoidian bargaining over a trade deal. Why were they so damn slow? Ryron needed in that sandcrawler, and she needed in there now. Ryron shifted her Gaderfi from her right hand to her left and shook the sand from her robes. Just pick something, you old fool. The Jawas sold junked-up droids made shiny with dollops of oil in the right places. Ryron snorted. Only an idiot farmer would be stupid enough to buy them. Moisture farmers, specifically. Ryron's hands closed tight over the blaster at her waist. Stinking, sweating peasants who thought they had more right to the desert and its gifts than she did. The farmer settled on a dull gold protocol unit, which jabbered at him in a tinny voice until the old man snapped at it to shut up. Typical. Farmers treated anything that didn't look like them like bantha dung. Droids, raiders, Jawas. All the same. Second class. Lesser. Ryron daydreamed about proving to them who exactly was lesser. She daydreamed about taking her father's Gaderfi and wreaking bloody havoc. And if not that, then simply proving herself. Proving that she was meant for more than hiding from crate dragons in the wastes, caring for her bantha and her children and her meat. But the raider women in her clan did not join battle. Never mind that she spun the Gaderfi better than any of her useless male cousins. Raider women did not fight, and raider women were not meant for more. And so Ryron's daydreams would continue to be just that. Unless... She hunched down behind the condenser. She didn't dare think on it, lest doing so drive the possibility from ever existing. There was no guarantee she'd even be able to steal the item the trader requested, let alone get it to him in one piece without the Jawas noticing. The old man and the boy finally settled on their second unit, a white and red striped astromech droid. The two new purchases tottered through the blistering sands toward the farmer's homestead. Not much time left now. Trunk! She needed a distraction. Would that she had an ally. Someone to make a ruckus, so she could dash into the sandcrawler, find the item, and disappear back into the wastes. Someone she could turn to. Someone who wanted off this hellish rock as badly as she did. She thought, briefly, of Quirurur. He wielded the Gaderfi with natural grace, deadly as a starving crate. He didn't think women should remain home during the raids. And he made her laugh. He was a good friend. Ryren would have liked him at her side, for she did not know what she would find in Mos Eisley when she took the item to the trader. He might cheat her, tell her that the price for a berth off planet had gone up. He might be selling her into slavery, and she wouldn't even know. Not until she was dropped onto Kessel to be starved and beaten and worked to death. Yes, it would be nice to have an ally. And Quiruer would have been a fine one. Too late now. She'd been gone long enough that her return would result in questions that she couldn't answer. Not without shaming her family. Not without earning weeks of icy silence from the rest of the clan. Even Quiruer wouldn't speak to her now. Not if he didn't want to be shamed as well. As if wanting something more than banthas and heat and raids was shameful. But as quick as Ryren's anger rose, it faded. Her people's ways allowed them to survive, though they were surrounded on all sides by enemies. She'd been gone only for a day, and already she yearned for her mother's black melon pudding, for the gravelly voice of her father as he told stories beside the fire. She would miss them. She knew it. And she would not see them again. For if she did make it off-planet, she could never return to Tatooine. No use dwelling. You've made your decision. Harsh words echoed off the flat, and Ryren turned her attention back to the moisture farmers and the Jawas. The old farmer was having words with the lead Jawa, gesticulating like a madman at the astromech droid, which billowed a damning plume of black smoke. The boy, standing beside the golden droid, gestured at another unit, squat and blue. Now, Ryren, while they're not looking. She dropped low, thankful for the simple child's mask she wore, made of leather and cloth. As the Jawas and the farmers argued over the droids, Ryren scuttled from behind the condenser into the shadow of the sandcrawler. She crept carefully into the hollow space between the two enormous tracks that carried the transport across Tatooine's unforgiving terrain. Then she turned her head up to the guts of the crawler, digging with gloved hands through wires and gears and tubes. There must be a handle around here. There must. There is. But where? The raised voices dropped. The mishap outside dealt with. Any moment the sandcrawler would move, and she'd be squashed between its tracks. Come on, Ryren! Her hands grew more frantic until finally her fingers closed on a long metal bar. Yes! She grabbed it, turned, and moments later lifted herself into a dim cargo hold. A scant bit of light filtered in from a row of tiny portals. Outside, the farmers escorted their new purchases into their homestead. The sandcrawler rumbled to life. Now! Find it! But where to begin? The grumble of the Jawas as they entered the front of the hold stopped her in her tracks, until she had the sense to dive behind a giant, rusted freighter engine. She couldn't hear the Jawas' steps. They walked lightly as cats. But she could smell the damn things. Ryren gagged beneath her mask. They were worse than the farmers, and with the hum of flies about them. The Jawas maneuvered the leftover merchandise back into the hold, and then their reek faded. The sandcrawlers slowly rolled east toward Tashi Station and Anchorhead. Ryren would need to be long gone by then. With that, she turned her attention to her search, but hopelessness quickly engulfed her. The trader hadn't given her much to go on. He'd found her in Beston 3 weeks ago, heavily hooded and trying to hawk stolen goods. He'd been lying low himself. Despite meeting twice with him, she'd yet to see his face, and knew only that he was humanoid in form. "It will be small," he'd told her. "Perhaps stored in a bag or a box, no larger than your hand. And it can be one of many colors, blue, green, purple. The Jawas will know what it is, and may have locked it away."
Ryren rifled through the nearest pile of junk before quickly dismissing it.
The Jawas were far more fastidious about their possessions than their hygiene. They wouldn't leave something of value just lying around. Her eyes adjusted to the darkness, but it was nearly impossible to tell which direction she should look in. All the piles of junk looked exactly the same. She cursed the Jawas. Stinking little hoarders. Her neck prickled, and she whirled, scanning the piles behind her. If there was a Jawa sneaking around back here, she'd know, right? She sniffed the air. Nothing but stale oil and rust. There! In the back left-hand corner of the hold, so covered up she'd nearly missed it, sat a large metal box. She edged closer, trying not to upset any of the piles of junk, wincing when a tray of tiny gears clattered loudly as she passed. She heard rustling at the front of the hold and hunkered down, waiting. The raspy voice of a Jawa sounded, and she didn't dare to even breathe. Leave! Leave! But the Jawa didn't leave. Instead, it trotted closer, muttering to itself. She could smell it. Hear the flies. It would turn at any moment and spot her hiding. Ryren tightened her hand on her blaster. She'd have to kill the damn creature. But moments later, the Jawa disappeared back toward the main hold, still muttering. The sandcrawler trundled onward. Ryren moved quickly for the box. It was nearly as tall as she was, and a lock hung from it. An ancient sort Ryren only ever heard of in the stories her father told. Ryren pulled on it. It should have come right off. Instead, she got a lungful of rust and suppressed a cough. Tarnka! She cast about until she found a long, heavy bar with a notch at the end. She wedged it between the two prongs of the lock and jerked down with all her might, huffing through her mask. The lock held. The sandcrawler began to slow. The next homestead wasn't far, and the Jawas would be back in the hold, pulling out their merchandise. If Ryren was going to find the trader's item, she needed to find it now. It might not even be in here. You might be wasting your time for nothing. But something, some strange feeling deep down in her gut, told Ryren that the item she needed was here. Just as she knew her mother's touch and the shuffle of her bantha, she knew that this lockbox held her salvation. The cargo hold clattered as the sandcrawler went over a bump. Ryren considered, then grabbed her blaster. She took a wary step back and, at the next bump, fired. The resulting blast incinerated the lock, and out the box, too. Ryren burned a hole through her glove, yanking the smoking lid open. Quickly! Quickly! She pawed through sacks of bolts, hair-thin gold wires, and what appeared to be the bones of some large animal. And then she spotted a shimmer, deep green, like the light that dashed across Tatooine's horizon at dusk. The moment the rock was in her hand, she felt whole, as if she'd been missing a limb her entire life and never known it, and she finally had it back. She marveled at it, a tiny thing, no longer than her palm, and jagged on one end. It was broken. Where was the other half? Ryren searched through the safe for the rest of the rock, but she sensed it wasn't there. At a sound on the other side of the cargo hold, she froze, terror in her stomach. Not for herself, but for the rock. They wouldn't take it from her. It belonged to her, no one else. But why this attachment? Why did she feel this way when she'd never even seen the thing before? She peered down at it, at the way it shimmered in the orange light of the hold. What power did it have over her? Was this what her mother spoke of when she spoke of the bond with her bantha? Ryren never felt it, though she'd raised the same mild-mannered beast since she was a child. To her, it was more a pet than a friend. If the attachment she felt to this rock was anything like what raiders were supposed to feel for their banthas, then Ryren understood the reason the beast was so revered among her people. She understood why raider unions succeeded or failed based on the relationship between the two partners' banthas. If this rock was ever taken from her, she'd wage war for it. And if she ever found the other piece of it, he who owned it would also own a piece of her, and she of him. How then will I part with it? How, when giving it to the traitor is the only way to escape this place? She looked through one of the tiny windows. The moisture farmer's homestead was long gone now, a bump in the distance. The boy would be bathing the droids, preparing them for work. In the meantime, the next farm was close enough that the outbuildings were in sight, their shadows long in the coming twilight. Night drew close, and Ryra knew she couldn't travel the desert safely after sunset. She didn't have time to think or ponder any longer. She had to go. Ryren found the hatch and waited beside it until the sandcrawler slowed to a halt. The second it did, she yanked open the hatch and dropped out, shoving it closed, just as the Jawas entered the hole to pull out their wares once more. Heart thudding, Ryren slipped through the tracks and around the crawler. She was a shadow, no more visible to the farmers emerging from their homes than a speck of dust. By nightfall, she'd have raided a nearby homestead for transport, and by morning, she'd be in Mos Eisley. At which point, she'd have to give the traitor the rock. Though, she frowned to herself as she gazed at it. It looks much more like a crystal than a rock. She wouldn't give it up. She couldn't. You won't have to, a calm voice within her said. You will find a way, when the time comes, to get what you need. You've gotten this far, haven't you? With that thought to sustain her, Ryren disappeared into Tatooine's approaching night, her blood singing at her future, clutched in her hands.
The Red One by Ray Carson. Sand was everywhere. In the little red droid's treads, in his articulation joints, even deep inside his activating couplers. Dust caked his photoreceptors so badly, he could only make out vague shapes. Not that it mattered. The extreme heat inside the sandcrawler, followed by the occasional nighttime snap freeze, had warped his casings badly. Between that and the grinding sand, he could only turn his head a few degrees to look at anything anyway. He could still vocalize, still flash his lights, still move his legs. But he'd been a prisoner on this blasted crawler for 4 years. Shopped around by Jawas to every moisture farmer in the territory. And in all that time, he'd received little to no maintenance. More than anything in the galaxy, he wanted to be sold. Escape the sandcrawler. Fulfill his programming by serving a new master. Someone who would clean his joints once in a while. Offer a few drops of lubricant. Give him a purpose. But time was running out. He was lonely. And he was dying. One evening, the little droid was snug in his nest of scrap metal, tucked away into the coolest, darkest corner of the cargo hold, when two Jawas approached. One carried a cylindrical object with a handle. A stunner, no doubt. The Jawas had finally given up on him. They would zap him, rip off any parts that still had value, and toss the rest of him into the furnace to melt for scrap. He gave a sad chirp of resignation, hoping it would be quick. To his surprise, the Jawas inspected him instead, nattering at each other. They communicated with sense as much as words, and the droid had never been fitted with olfactory receptors. but he understood enough. Something about a farm, an astromech droid. And clear as a Tatooine day came that wonderful, glorious word, sell. The Jawas argued, but came to an agreement quickly. One left. The other lifted the cylindrical object toward the droid, who twittered at the Jawa, afraid to hope. The creature said nothing in response. It simply tipped the object, and a cool drop of thick lubricant suddenly coated the droid's left photoreceptor, blurring everything. Carefully, the Jawa used the edge of its sleeve to wipe away sand and grime. Then it placed generous drops of lubricant in his joints. His head swiveled, his treads, everything that had been grinding to a slow, awful death by sand these last 2 years. The red droid let out a whirring sigh. Nothing had ever felt so good. Sure, he could only remember 4 years back, to the point of his memory wipe, but he was certain that nothing in his entire mysterious existence had been as magnificent as this. The Jawa scraped sand out of his tool compartments, wiped down his other photoreceptors, gave him a pat on the head, and left him alone in his nest of scrap. He stared after the creature, his vision a little less scratched and blurry now, and marveled at his fortune. If he understood correctly, a nearby farm had specifically requested an astromech droid. And since the Jawas had gone to the trouble of cleaning him up a little, he had a good chance of finally finding a new master. The little droid hunkered into his nest and powered down to save energy. By morning, he would be his brightest, cleanest self. Mere hours later, when the scorching heat was giving way to evening coolness, a jolt woke him. He lurched up, the washers and springs and scrap shavings of his nest tumbling off his head. He recognized that clanging sound and the flurry of Jawa excitement that followed. The sandcrawler's magnet had suctioned up a new bit of scavenge, which was now being deposited into the cargo hold. He swiveled his head for a better look, expecting to see the usual bit of decades-old wreckage. A shape materialized in the darkness. It was small, barely more than a meter tall, with a domed top. A round silver body glinted in the meager light, trimmed with shiny blue. It blurted angrily, threatening the Jawas with death if they didn't back off right this second. The red droid was so happy to hear binary, the first language of his programming, that it took a moment for the implication to register. Another astromech. In beautiful condition. An elite R2 unit, no less, as superior to his own line as a blaster to an angry fist. Oh, he would never be sold now. No one would pick him over the newcomer. The R2 unit continued to protest as Jawas fitted him with a restraining bolt. The creatures ignored his threats, talking excitedly with one another. This was the second fully functioning droid they'd pulled from the sand today. An unprecedented fortune. Clearly their luck was changing. Soon theirs would be the richest clan in the territory. When the R2 unit's restraining bolt was fixed tight, he gave one last indignant bleep, then scooted across the cargo hold to chat with the sandcrawler's earlier discovery. A golden droid with a grating voice. They seemed to know each other. As the little red droid powered down, he wondered what it might be like to have bright lights and a sleek casing and a head swivel that could rotate without pain. To have someone to talk to. In the dead of night, he was jolted awake a second time by a mechanical arm prodding his access compartment. He squealed, swinging his body around to dislodge the thing poking him. The silver and blue droid stood before him, caught in the act of sabotage, his pincer appendage dangling in the air. He whimpered a sad apology. The red droid bleated indignation.
Sorry for sabotaging me, or sorry you were caught.
Yes,
the other replied. Then he introduced himself.
I'm R2D.